I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hi everyone, my name's Nayuka. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people on whose we land on right now. I'd like to acknowledge their continuing sovereignty and their resistance. I might get us all to introduce ourselves, if that's okay, because I feel like I can never do that justice. Did you want to start off?
Yeah, sure. Dingi Walla Dimbalungs. Hello, friends. My name's Melissa Lukashenko. I'm a Bundjalung and Russian writer. I live between Brisbane and the Bundjalung Nation, and I feel, I feel really lucky to be a visitor on Gadigal land and to get a chance to talk to you mob from down south and share a few stories and get to talk about my work, which is a bit of a, it's sort of a blessing for a writer because you, as a writer you live in a room, an 8 by 10 foot room for most of your life, and it's a lonely existence, so it's nice to be able to actually commune with the readership and share something. Thanks.
Yamamalia, hello friends, I'm Nadi Simpson. I'm a Yuluroi woman, northwest New South Wales. I was born on Gadigal country, so I feel very lucky. Most of the joys of my life have happened here. My son was born here, my mother was born here. And so I feel very deeply a respect for all that I've received here. Why am I up here? I don't know. This is, I wish I was in a 10 by 8 foot room right now.
They never tell you when you write a book that you're going to have to talk to thousands of people.
Oh, dear. There's a book around there in the shop, which is probably why I'm here.
You should all buy it too. Yeah, as I said before, my name's Nayuka. I'm a Gunai Kurnai Gunajmara Wiradjuri and Yorta Yorta woman. I moved back home onto our country late last year because COVID was just, you know, we didn't really leave the house much. And the whole time I was in the house, I needed to go home. Like I needed trees and bush and our house was concrete. So I got really fixated on, I got really obsessed with country. And one of the few kind of escapes that I had in that time was reading a lot of blackfellas and the way that blackfellas were talking about country. And it was one of the reprieve from the city and the concrete. So when Michael, the festival director, he asked me, are you interested in doing this? One of the things I really wanted to talk to blackfellas about was the craft of writing country. I just want to know how you do what you do, basically. But first we might start off with the first question is, so whose country is it anyway? It's ours. I want to know how you write country in the way that you do. I know that's a really big question, but as writers, how do you do it?
Oh, look at me.
Yeah, go on.
It is a big question. I suppose I was at the Paul Kelly concert last night and Paul said something that was not new to me but a reminder, and he said, writers pay attention. And I think there's two sorts of writers, actually. There's the kind of Hemingway writers who are very loud and full of themselves and macho, not necessarily male, but macho and like to talk and be very extrovert, and they produce one kind of writing. And then there's the other kind of writer who stands back and is literally bearing witness and pays attention. And I grew up in Brisbane in the it's Yuggera country on the southern outskirts, and It was very bushy. Lived on a small acreage that my Russian grandparents carved off, realising that my father was a complete lunatic who would never, ever be able to support a family without a land base. So that was the gift. That was like the huge gift of my life, to grow up in one place for 17 years and to be fed from that soil, because we grew a lot of our food, grew probably 50% of our food growing up. Pawpaw, beans, pumpkins, sweet corn, sweet potato, strawberries, mulberries, you name it. We grew it and we ate it. And so that red soil, it fed us and it fed me physically and it fed me emotionally and it fed me spiritually. And I spent a lot of time on the back of a horse. We were poor, but my father scraped together enough money to buy a pony off a bloke up the road. And when you're riding a horse, or at least when I'm riding a horse, I'm always watching the ground. You look for snake holes, bandicoot holes, anything that your horse is going to step on and hurt itself on, or trip over and you fall off and break your neck. So literally, for my entire childhood, I was paying attention to country, riding through the bush, looking for that snake, looking for that root that the horse would trip over. And I think that's a habit that has served me really well as a writer. It's more complicated when you're an adult because your life becomes more complex. You have children, you have different jobs, and it's not simply a matter of saddling up in the morning, jumping on your horse and paying attention. You know, I wish it was. Maybe when I retire it can be again.
What about you?
Thinking about the question and, you know, what we are fortunate to inherit, which is this sort of never-ending belonging. But the answer to the question of whose country is it anyway is, and the beautiful complexity of how I understand this stuff, is that it actually depends where you're standing. And so we have this never-changing bond to a place, yet that place is fluid depending where you stand. Mm-hmm. I love that, because actually that's something that, you know, belongs to us as blackfellas, but also now is part of the makeup of who we are as a collective. And, you know, people are writing letters to each other and addressing it to Gadigal country. That's out. That's a movement of Australians. And that kind of interaction with place makes me feel really deadly, that it's not, we don't have to just look after that anymore. It's not just us saying there are 350 however many number of mobs in this country. Other people are saying, that's an important thing to know and I want to connect to it in this way. And it starts with an address on an envelope. Or actually, you know, envelopes are going way of the dodo. But people are doing it on emails now. And so the joy we have in knowing about our place, or having this unfolding relationship with our place, and knowing that the way I connect is different to the way you connect, but just as strong. The beauty of that is being shared with other people. And stepping back, what does that mean? We're thinking about country, which is what we are obliged to do, I believe, as blackfellas, but you guys are doing it too. And that makes place strong. Not to say that it's all, you know, roses and daisies and, you know. I don't know why I've got a vision of a horse going riding in the sunset. It's a hard thing to navigate, but creating a relationship with place that is important to you, and then knowing it may be completely different 200 metres down the road, and being okay with that, being okay with what you know and knowing that that may mean nothing somewhere else, is an important thing.
When you say that, you know, to go back to the original question of whose country is it, I don't think there are any simple answers to that. And I was thinking as you were talking, Nadi, what non-Aboriginal Australians and Aboriginal Australians who have grown up off country or disconnected have this, I think, gaping psychological wound of disconnection and of having to pretend and having to suppress the true history. And so when we talk about treaty and the urgent need for treaty or treaties, the political response is one of, oh, we would be giving you something if we did that. Like, we would be graciously granting Aboriginal Australia something and Torres Strait Islander Australia something that you're asking for. Another interesting word that Paul Kelly used last night was reparations. I don't think I've ever heard that word come out of a white man's mouth before, so that was interesting. So in that sense, yes, you know, people with a provable connection to country do seek reparations and do seek justice. So it's not that we're not asking for things, but the gift of treaty would be that all of Australia can go forward, you know, in a completely different manner. It started with Mabo, all right? Before Mabo, the conversation was quite different. And now, it's not an accident that we can now have Gadigal country on emails or that there's more blackfellas at Sydney Writers' Festival. All this stuff has come through from Mabo because the terror of admitting that we were here has eased off a bit since Mabo. There has been some structural change. Okay, not enough. We need treaty. And then the gift of belonging to this country in a legitimate way, in a profound and emotionally solid way, will belong to every Australian. That's what came into my mind when you were talking.
I'm interested to know, I guess I was being a bit facetious when I was like, it's our country, because it is, it's a lot more complex. And
well, there's two laws. Aunty Mary Graham says there are two laws in this country. Under our law, of course it's our country. Under white law, as it stands, it's not. And that's just the reality, you know, that's the political reality.
Yeah, yeah. I'm interested to know, like, how... I guess writing of country, like part of the very first, like since invasion, one of, I guess, the colonial activities or the things that has enabled colonisation was writing about this place. So the first descriptions of country by whitefellas and invaders was an act of colonisation and violence. And I guess that is a tradition that is a part of like the canon, I suppose, in the way that places like this, even now we see them described as the wilderness or wild and untamed, as though there is an inch of this country that hasn't been touched by us before.
It's really bizarre because at the same time as we are writing and being read and winning prizes and talking in schools constantly, doing all the stuff we do, and there's an audience for that, at the same time, there's things like a Wikipedia entry that I read. I'm writing a novel of colonial Brisbane at the moment. And so I go to the Wikipedia for the Brisbane River, and sometime in the early 2000s, this Wikipedia entry was created, and it said something like, the Brisbane River is a large, you know, river of eastern Australia, blah, blah, blah. It is thought that the Yuggera people roamed about in the area before white settlement. And I actually used the word roamed about.
just roaming.
Yeah,
just walking.
You know, not constructed civilizations, not invented governments and laws, not worked out how to live sustainably in a way that, you know, operated for tens of thousands of years. Just roaming, you know.
Waiting.
Yeah.
Waiting for white people to get here, yes. Really. So give us some direction.
Anxiously scanning the horizon.
Where do I go? I don't know where to roam to next. Where are we going?
All roads lead to Rome.
When in Rome. But I'm interested to know, like, in your practice as well, how you write in a way that isn't extractive or isn't harmful. Because I think you both do... It's just reading your work feels really good for the soul, and reading the way that you write about country makes me feel really good. But it's not always like that. You know, reading settlers' work isn't always like that. So I want to know how... Is that something you think about in your work?
It is, but Nadi, you go.
I dedicated the book to my Ngurrumba, to my homeland, because I want a continuing, evolving relationship with that place. And it doesn't matter where I am, I'm always trying to practice that. And so I care very deeply and I think about it a lot, probably because I'm not there. We spoke very briefly before we started. I find ways to get there even if I'm sitting right here. And when I'm not thinking about it, it's still thinking about me. It's sort of the most epic relationship in my life. I look after that. When I write about it, I make sure that I choose words that are reflective of how important it is to me, good and bad, positive and negative. But I am always... there's no kind of word I can think of right now. It's sort of like how I feel, you know, living here, being, you know, living on somebody else's homeland and being... knowing I receive all the beauty of this place. I don't think about what it is I cannot access. I think about how lucky I am to have what I have. And then know that the people who own this place have a much bigger space and place to talk and move and act. And that's fine with me, because them doing that makes me strong. It's that kind of feeling of it's not about not having, but it's about being grateful of what you do have and allowing the space for other people to have more is what I try and write when I think about place. What is open to me and what I am able to talk about and able to dream about and able to create, and the limits of that. And that is not a barrier to me. It's where somebody else starts. And that's how I want to do my business. That's how I want to live my life. I talk about this and someone talks about that, and they talking about that is making me strong, happy. You writing your work, talking your words is filling me up as a Yuluroi Wiringar, a black woman. You know? That's what country teaches me, I think. You know, fences and boundaries and properties and stuff. Sort of enclosing places. But actually, on the other side of that are lives and people and families. And if you can find a way to connect and make that part of your life, you're not missing out on anything. You continue on over that fence. You're invested in what happens over there, and they look after that for you. That's what I try and evoke when I think about place, because that's what I think place teaches me.
Oh, I could listen to you talk all day. You may... yeah. What about you?
Yeah, it's an interesting word, extractive, isn't it? I haven't seen it so much recently, but when I was a younger writer, there was a kind of a tone in the debate in mainstream writing about it was kind of a savagery of writers are stealers of other people's ideas, and as if that was a good thing, and writers are ruthless in pursuing their art, and you know the kind of cult of the individual that lies, you know, at the heart of the Western project, I guess, of which I'm, you know, part, as well as to the side of. You know, you can't avoid it if you grow up in a Western country. That seems to have faded slightly, that the kind of gentleness, the kind of reciprocity that Nadi evokes in her work and that we all aim for, that comes directly out of traditional culture. And I think that comes out of time, the time span of relationships. You know, Uncle Dennis Foley wrote a book that came out late last year or early this year, called What the Colonists Never Knew. And Uncle Dennis is a senior traditional owner for the north part of Sydney around Narrabeen. He partly grew up near Narrabeen Lakes with his family, and they lived off the land to an extent, even in the 60s, and before he was taken away. And he wrote that book with Peter Reid, the historian, and the kind of weaving of the Aboriginal and the non-Aboriginal voice and their conversation about Sydney, and the way that Uncle Dennis talks, it showed me how deeply the relationships run in traditional culture. You know, funny to think that you could learn that from a man that grew up within metropolitan Sydney, but it's there. You don't have to go to the Kimberley or Alice Springs. So, you know, if you're living in a region on country and you know that your great-great-great-great-grandchildren are going to have to be talking and living with and marrying and trading with the people in your area, you're going to behave respectfully. You're going to know that those relationships need to be nurtured gently and thoughtfully. And I think that's the difference. You know, what I try to do in my writing is even though violent acts occur in my writing, I try not to enact that violence upon the reader. And I don't care if it's an Aboriginal reader or a Pacifica reader or an Arab reader or a reader in Chicago that's Irish-American. To show the world in all its beauty and its pain and its horror and its potential without injuring the reader is something that I work towards. And I'm writing about colonial Brisbane, you know, hugely violent place. And so now I'm grappling with how to do that, how to do justice to the truth of history, but how to protect the crystal of life that sits in us all and that we all must protect. I don't know if that's a bit philosophical or something.
No, as a writer, how do you talk about trauma without replicating it?
Exactly, yeah.
We don't, yeah.
And it's easy to do, you know, it's easy to think that that's the right thing to do. You know, this nation has damaged us, it's invaded us, it's taken our children, it's taken our law, it's taken our government. It's taken and taken and taken and taken and taken. And so the natural response of an immature writer is to lash out and do the same thing back to the reader and to just vent. And there's a place for that writing, but there's also a need for a writing that heals and does the opposite. And, you know, you talk to any elders, they'll tell you Aboriginal culture is inclusive and life must sit at the centre of our work. So I say to new writers, I say, we must write about life twice as much as we talk about death. Yeah. Otherwise, we're just invading ourselves all over again.
Yeah, far out. I'm kind of want to pivot a little bit I guess I want to know how you work on something like books. I don't know how long you it took to write your book, but I imagine it takes a while. You give so much of your life and your time and energy to this thing, this like living thing, and then it goes out into the world. And it's such a, like, having seen my mum do this, you know, she wrote for like 10 years or however long it was, and then suddenly it's, you know, printed and then people are reading. I guess I'm interested to know what it's like seeing other people see your thing and how your work is received and what happens when people really get what you were doing and what happens when people really don't get what you were doing. Because I remember actually at the Gold Coast, we were dropping you home and sorry, I'm pointing.
You were saying that fingers out now. Sorry.
And you were telling me, Whit, you were like, oh, I think this book is going to piss everyone off.
That's right.
And so, like, you were, and I think you're in the edits and you were kind of, yeah, anticipating how it was going to be received. And I want to know, did it piss everyone off?
No, well, too much slip. I was actually frightened for the 2 years that I was, you know, solidly writing the book. I thought I'd get ripped by the community. I thought it'd annoy the hell out of white readers. Not that that bothers me much. I had no idea if it would win any prizes or not, and it didn't do any good in the early prizes, like the New South Wales Literary Awards got long-listed maybe for two, shortlisted for one, certainly didn't pick up. I thought, oh, well, this book is not, it's not the moment for this book, and I've written the book that I'm happy to have written, and that's okay, and if people don't get it, I've done the best I can. And I know people always read the book that they want to read. You know, you can write anything you want, but people will read their own version of that book, and there's nothing a writer can do to control that. And then, you know, things changed and the book did really well, and the number of Aboriginal women who've come up to me, you know, old and young, and thanked me and said, and, you know, divulged their stories, which also kept happening during the writing, and every time I thought, no, I can't write this book, it's Aboriginal men have been demonised so much, it's not going to work. And then another woman would come and, just not knowing what I was writing, tell me her story. I thought, yeah, okay, I do have to write it. And with Sisters Inside, the prisoner rights organisation that I helped found in the 90s, we did a film, a short film about, would have been 2006, and there were aunties from Palm Island there, and they were saying, we have to tell the truth about what's happening in our communities and stop pretending that it's not happening. And I would go back, I don't know her name, but I'd go back to the image of that auntie in my head when I sort of felt too scared to keep going. And I thought, no, do it. And, so the reception was completely different to what I expected, you know, overwhelmingly different. You never know.
I didn't think you were demonising. I thought...
Oh, well, I was trying desperately not to.
Like, it was...
Yeah, but people read the book that they want to read.
Yeah. I thought it was a really, like, loving and... Mm. Yeah, it was a really...
I think Paola Bella said it.
Yeah.
At the Stella Prize night a few years ago, and she stood up and she said about, you know, abuse and love can live in the same house. And that's really what I was trying to say, and just hoping against hope that people saw the love as well as the rest of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. What about you? How's your book? What's that feeling like?
When you were talking earlier, I was thinking about, talking about culture. And there's a beautiful elder... lives in Sydney, he's a Yuin man, Uncle Max Harrison. He said something to me that just, you know, I was at a time in my life where I was trying to, you know, achieve things, you know, tick things off a list. you know, and getting quite possessive about what I was, where, you know, what I was doing. And he was talking about something completely unrelated. He said, you've got to give it away to keep it. Those words rocked me because I was doing the opposite, but I understood what he's talking about. And so, you know, when it got to publishing, I thought to myself, they've only got to print two of these. You know, let them go. they only need to do two, because I want one on the shelf in Wildwood High School and one on the shelf in Lightning Ridge High School. That's it. And I, you know, whether they're opened or not, I don't actually care. I want them to sit there. And maybe one day some young fella will go and open it and see a little bit of who they are. That's what I wanted to do. So everything after that and all the other bookshelves and places they are is wonderful. But I made it for us. And I've been lucky to have people say, for people to recognise that it is part of us. That'll do me, you know. But Uncle, going back to Uncle Max, you've got to give it away to keep it. I was thrown into a whirlpool of people and ideas and words and beautiful relationships with editors and everybody else. And then it flew out the window and it's got nothing to do with me now. I had my time with that story and it told me what it needed, what I needed to know, and now it belongs away from me. I think about that, oh man, you've got to give it away to keep it. I will always have the experience of writing that, the intensity of shaping and forming it, and the joy of people connecting to it, but it's way bigger than me. And I let it be that.
It's a whole world. Well, it's more than one world. It's you have to just bloody read it. It's just...
Make you tired, eh?
It's amazing. It is, yeah. It's so much. Me and Melissa, when I was charged up, chill Melissa's ear off, we were talking about how it was like... just like philosophy, and it's so much, it's so big, and
it's not like philosophy, it is philosophy.
Yeah.
I remember where I was going with the thing about Uncle Dennis before. I endorsed, you've got to give these things time. I endorsed Uncle Dennis and Peter Reed's book, and the strip line that I think they ended up using, which I hope they used, is there has never been a book like this before. And it sounds like hyperbole. You know, it sounds kind of ridiculous to say that about any book because, you know, was it Archimedes who said there's nothing new under the sun? I don't know if he ever saw a kangaroo. But when I said there has never been a book like this before, what I meant was there has never been a collaboration based in the oldest civilization on Earth writing about a major capital city. You know, if you actually think, if you stop and think past the kind of plastic superficiality that is attached to all things Aboriginal in Australia, and you think, this is... you know, this Australia is the elder of the world in terms of culture. We have had time. It's got very little to do with the superiority or inferiority or anything of Aboriginal people. It's time. You know, if you think what mainstream Australia has developed in the terms of a culture in 230 odd years, right? There is a culture. It has good aspects. It has bad aspects. You know, it's capitalistic and extractive and it's going to destroy the planet if we let it. But leaving that aside, a culture has developed in 230 years. Now imagine the time span of 80,000 years. Imagine what people learnt in that time. It's actually literally unimaginable unless you go to the source. If you read Nadi's article in Griffith Review called Gifts Across Space and Time, I think, it will really tear the blinkers from your eyes, and not tear is violent. The scales will fall from your eyes if you read that article in Griffith Review, because you'll actually glimpse what's been missing. And you'll understand that there's a really different way to be, and that's what Uncle Dennis touched on. That's what the Song of the Crocodile will show readers if they're ready to read it, you know? Nadi has written a profound book, a really profound novel, and the readership is essentially not yet ready for it, I don't think. But anyway, you can read it and make up your own mind.
I've got just a couple more questions, but before you were talking, Melissa, about like when you were young, you could pay attention and like you had, that's all you had to do all day. And then I guess as we get older, there's just things that take our attention, or we have, you know, we give our attention willingly to other things. But if your job is as a writer to pay attention, what, as someone who is chronically late with deadlines, I was late to this event, like how, what are the ways that you, what's your practice in giving attention as a writer? Are the things that you purposely do to notice what's going on?
Yeah, well, it's a constant, it is a practice. You know, I've done a bit of Zen meditation over the years, not much of late because my joints don't allow me to sit still for very long. I try and remove myself from net. We've got a bit of land with a cabin on it outside of network, which is a huge help. Just whether I sit and read there or not, or I'm just wandering the property and you know, watching birds and whatever, to remove myself from the internet is a great blessing. And it's really about getting out of your own way, about trying, you know, the demon of the ego, which we all have, and which our traditional culture is so adept at minimising, you know, at you know, trying to remind us that we're not the centre of the universe and never will be and shouldn't ever be. Just constantly coming back to, I'm nervous about a session, you know. What's the session for? Is the session for me to look wonderful and, you know, erudite and whatever, or is the session to share something with an audience and we all go away enriched? Just trying to get out of my own way as much as possible, and trying to be slow, you know, trying to do things slowly. Yindyamara, to do gently and slowly and lawfully. That's probably the best guide to being mindful.
It's hard to be slow, eh? Like, it can be really, yeah.
I actually love slowness. I love it. I really love it. And ironically, because given that I love slowness, I'm very good at meeting deadlines. I think I've missed one deadline in 20-odd years.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think I've made one deadline. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, the respect and the gentleness that we were talking about before, you've got to have that for your work.
Yeah.
And that's why I work slowly. You know, you can't churn out a book, you know, a year, unless you're a freak like Tony Birch, and do it well. You know, if there's perfectionism, which is something else, but if you've got respect for yourself as an artist and a respect for the work that you're doing, it'll take the time that it takes. You know, it's like a crop. Uncle Bruce Pascoe's growing a grain called dancing grass, and the Saturday paper has got a recipe for dancing grass crumpets, which is just beautiful when you think about it. And, you know, you can't plant dancing grass and expect it to ripen the next week or the next month. It takes the time that it takes, and so does work. And the more you allow the rhythm of a practice and the rhythm of a work to infuse what you're doing, the easier it becomes. It's when we're fighting that natural rhythm, I think, that we get into trouble.
Okay, absolutely.
There's also whipbirds on the property. Does everyone know what a whipbird sounds like? Trip, trip. In my mind, that's get up and work. Oh.
What about you, Nadi?
My life is hectic. So when I write, it's a release from that. And thinking, actually listening and thinking about the words that are weaving in the room, I think my life is hectic providing people what they need, which I love. When I am able to make time and space for what I want to do, then that becomes slow and meditative for me. So, and at the moment, that kind of, those are polar opposites work because, you know, I'm making money and paying rent, but then the things that I want to explore, I do quietly and slowly. And being sort of out there enables me to know what slow is and to feed that kind of way of being. I think probably my personality is the type that needs both of those things. It just makes that writing time really special and feel very different to what I do in my day. So I found by accident a good balance that works for me. But strangely, like I'll often go and write when I'm thinking very deeply or focusing on a thought or an idea. I'll go and write in a cafe because with that noise and the movement and the people and, you know, I think also that helps because, you know, we're lucky we can dream up anything. We can be the creator of an entire universe. That's not a healthy thing. Because when you close that book, you're living this life. And that thing may not relate. There's a huge danger that that thing doesn't talk this language. And so, you know, maybe for me it's a juggling of really quiet time where I explore very deeply things that are new or old to me. And then I need the injection of reality in a fictional world for it to be able to have meaning to others. Yeah.
Do you dream, when you were writing, did you dream in the world that you were writing?
No, I'm pissed off about that. you know, I hear all these people and, you know, amazing song men and women taking that off. They dream songs, you know, or not even black fellas. Sometimes, you know, people top of the charts dream a song and they write it and they make $1 million. Not that, you know, I'm not, that'd be nice. But, you know, I think how come all these fellas can connect in different ways? I want that. But, you know, I think a lot about Uncle Max. What would he tell me? He said, he would say, you don't do it like that. Yeah. Don't want that thing because you're getting it in other ways. You're getting it when you're walking down the street and when you're in the cafe. That's your dreaming. Don't worry. You don't need to lay down, go to sleep and snore it. Doesn't stop me from wanting it, though. Somehow there's this kind of, you know, people, oh, wow, she dreams stories. You know, what would I think if I met somebody like that? I think, yeah, bullshit. Unless that's how...
I do have incredible dreams. I said to my partner last week, if people knew what I dreamt about last night, they would lock me up.
Okay.
Amazing dreams, sometimes very violent, but not always, just bizarre. But the story that I think of with dreams is it was 2004 when I just moved with my then husband and kids to the farm that is the setting for Mullumbimby. I pretty much lifted the setting and put it straight into the book because I was dying of homesickness after losing it. But we'd just got the farm at this stage, and my brother brought down an Arabian horse that he had and gave it to us. And it wasn't a quiet horse. And, you know, I used to be a good rider. I'm not much of a rider anymore, and I'm certainly not fit like I was as a kid. But I used to be a good rider and good horsewoman. Anyway, I was mucking around with this horse, and I was on the ground. And I forget exactly what the horse did, but I ended up concussed. I fell backwards and hit my head, hit the back of my head on a rock in the ground that was not a big rock, just a stone. And for about a week afterwards, whether I was asleep or awake, these dreams that I'd had decades earlier would come into my consciousness. You know, they're all stored there. The scientists will tell you that your dreams don't go away. They're stored somehow in your brain. And it was just incredible to know that all these events, all these stories were in my own head, but I couldn't access them until I got concussed by this bloody horse. But, yeah, it's... I do have amazing dreams. Sorry, sis.
That's so cool.
It was really cool, and if I knew how to fall and hit my head in the same way, I would do it. I really would. No word of a lie, I would do it.
That is really, really cool. So I've been doing a lot of writers' rooms at the moment, helping make TV shows, and I find just after, maybe 2 days in the same writer's room, I start dreaming about the characters.
Yeah.
And it's just, I wondered, because, you build these really cool worlds if it was the same for you. That's so cool, though. If you want, you pay me some money, we can arrange the concussion.
I could probably arrange it without paying. Shall we take any questions or not? I don't mind taking one or two.
Okay.
I don't know if Nadi'd.
I'm happy.
Could I just bring us back to the question and the idea of country? Because the story of Australia in many ways is the collision of men arriving here whose view of land was they owned it, meeting a culture where, as I understand it, you belong to it. And so much of Indigenous fiction teaches non-Indigenous readers about your conception of country, which is obviously a very rich idea. Does your conception of country encompass, or can it encompass in some way, in a positive way, the non-Indigenous?
Country is everything. And this is the nub of the problem, you know. My understanding of, you know, the traditional idea of country, which is probably quite shallow compared to yours, Nadi. It's not land. It's not land and trees. It's everything. It's the stars. It's the moonlight. You know, it's the possum fur. It's the sound of the magpie. It's the water. It's the dew. It's all people. And what we have in Australia at the moment is country that it has a great gulf within it, and that's what needs to be healed. What do you think, Mum?
Country isn't a place. It's actually not a place. But you foster that within you, and of course we can incorporate. We have been incorporating everybody, non-Indigenous people, in our concept of country. The question is, can you incorporate us? And how big is that space that you're prepared to give us? And are you comfortable in there being different understandings of country? We don't all need to agree. In fact, when we don't agree, it becomes interesting. That's life, right? So I'll never forget Bob Brown. They asked Bob Brown, you know, saying there seems to be a little bit of, you know, disagreement in the party room, you know, 50 million microphones in front of him. He said, well, I would hope so. He nailed it. that difference is the beauty. So if I can say country means this to me, these deadly ladies say it means that to you and you have it, how do we find a way for that all to work? Humans are good at that. Doing it on letters and emails already. But I mean, if it's not a place, it's a space for people and relationships, I think. What space are you prepared to give others in that? Because we're doing it. So that's the model that shows you it can be done. That's what I reckon, yeah.
Can you join me in giving these two incredible women a round of applause?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.